Welcome to Season 3 of Inflammation Nation. My name is Peter Boyd. Inflammation Nation is a podcast from Arthritis Ireland aimed at increasing awareness and understanding of arthritis and related conditions. And you're very welcome to this latest episode of Inflammation Nation. My name is Peter Boyd, and I'm glad to say I'm joined today by Dr. Jennifer Wilson O'Reilly, Principal Clinical Psychologist in Beaumont Hospital here in Dublin, who specialises in the treatment of patients experiencing psychological distress. Hopefully we get through some answers on the questions around managing and coping with our invisible illnesses in the next little while. First of all, Jenny, you're very welcome to the show and to the podcast. The first question I really have is, it's a really fascinating area of people are always asking about psychology and looking into the mind and everything like that. Do you fall into a career like that, or is it something you've always wanted to do?
That's a great question, Peter. I mean, I was very lucky that I started my undergraduate in English because I had done like written poetry and stuff in high school. And then I went into because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. And I had a mentor in the English department. And when I look back now, I'm like, oh, it's so embarrassing. But I remember going to him after a first year in college and saying, I just can't really justify a life in English. I was talking to the English professor at the time. And he very kindly said, you know, what other opportunities are there here? And so at that point, I switched. I mean, I completed my studies in English, but I also did a degree in psychology. And when I was doing that, I realized that actually psychology had been a passion of mine for a long time.
Okay.
You know, that I'd always been interested in what makes people work and, you know, asking questions, you know, and finding out, you know, their motivations, but also their strengths, you know, and just learning about people. And I realized, like, my mom was really good at that, too. So, you know, it was obviously there from the beginning, but
It needed a little steer. Yeah, and kind of somebody to push you in the right direction, maybe positively or negatively, if it's away from English.
He was so kind not to say, get out of my office.
And I suppose if you're doing that naturally as you're growing up and you have your friends and you're doing that, you may be doing it in college. You're kind of looking at them, and the more you read about a subject, you're maybe analysing them or anything like that. Did you find yourself doing that as you went through university?
Well, yeah. And actually, you know, the study of English literature and poetry, it isn't a million miles away from psychology because you're always looking for connections. You're always looking for, you know, themes and morals and all the things that, you know, bring like a narrative together. So even now, sometimes when I'm working with people, I'm thinking about the story of their lives and not just what's happened to them, but also how they themselves interpret their own story. You know, that people create a narrative around the meaning of things that happen to them. So that's not like a million miles away from, you know, what people do, say, in studying English literature. And like, ironically now, I'm not full circle because I'm sticking with psychology, but I'm like publishing a novel next year. You know what I mean? And it's all about like this whole idea of how do people think about what has happened to them? And just kind of coming back to the introduction too, I mean, I do specialize in working with people with psychological distress, but most of my work is around people with, you know, psychological distress, but also health conditions. And it's a really interesting area because we have, like, everybody's walking around with a body. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, you know, can ignore that, you know, for the most part. But people with long-term health conditions or even acute illnesses, their body is constantly giving them feedback. Like, they cannot afford to not think about their illness a lot of the time. And so how they work that into the narrative and the stories that they tell themselves and that they experience in their lives is like the crux of my work. So, you know, it's all coming together, Peter.
Yeah, it was all meant to be, even though you didn't know it at the time.
Exactly.
And if you look at that narrative and we take it through, you know, the people that you're dealing with, they're living with a condition that is mainly invisible in many ways, more than myself. And we have those really strong emotions, the fear, the guilt, the shame at times. And it kind of gives us that kind of fear of speaking up or speaking out. But I suppose that narrative is coming through all the time that you describe. We're listening to it and we're telling ourselves that story. Are we exacerbating it by not sharing the narrative, sharing the story?
That's a super question. You know, I've been at Beaumont now for over 20 years, and I'm really proud of that because I've learned so much from the patients that I've met over the course of those years. And one of the things that always surprises me is that, like I said before, we're all embodied. Like, nobody gets out of this life alive. Like, we all die in the end. I remember I used to show this slide from The Onion, like that satirical magazine or newspaper, where they'd have like, they had like death rates, you know, on like a bar chart. And it was like 100%, 100%, 100%. You know, so we all are going to die, you know, and we all have these bodies that are, you know, going to be faulty at different points mm-hmm. in our lives. And so what always surprises me in the work with people with long-term health conditions, not everybody, is that they do feel this sense of guilt, you know, and sometimes they do feel a sense of shame around having to maybe step back from their commitments or ask for help or, you know, whatever it is that triggers it. It's always amazing to me how it finds its way in, even though we all have bodies that will let us down in the end. So your question about, does it make it worse for us if we don't talk about it? You know, is it exacerbated when it's invisible and we don't talk about it? It's a kind of a nuanced question because there are times when it's helpful for people to keep their privacy. But then there are other times when it's really helpful for people to make connections. And I think that's something that Arthritis Ireland is so good for, because it's a really safe place for people to talk about their illnesses and to talk about their symptoms with other people who experience, you know, bodies who are faulty in similar ways. Yeah. But yeah, I do think to answer your question, like if I could answer it quickly, which clearly I can't, I might say something like feeling separate from other people does make us more at risk. So not sharing can do that.
It can. And it's something that, you know, we experience. And that lived experience of bodies that are faulty, you know, and it's often said, you know, if you haven't experienced it, you may not understand it fully. And then we meet the well-meaning friends, the well-meaning family, mm-hmm. and with an invisible condition, they turn around to us and they say, oh, but you look so great and you don't look sick. And they're all trying their best to make us feel better. And they don't really have a comprehension of what we're going through, the pain and the discomfort. So how do we manage those unsolicited comments? How do we manage those really well-meaning people in our lives, but that are almost hurting us by not recognizing that our bodies are faulty?
Again, a really great question around kind of communication and connection and understanding. And I mean, in that question, there's a few things going on, right? Because mm-hmm. it's like what people say and what we hear. So somebody says, oh, well, you know, I'm sorry to hear you're sick, but you look so good. And we hear, you're not really that sick, are you? You know, it's a really interesting little connection there or combination of experiences. And I think, you know, with illness, I mean, if people have been healthy, like if they've been privileged enough to be healthy in their childhood and growing up, they have, you know, they can carry this myth in their lives around their control over their own bodies, right? It's like, if I exercise, if I eat properly, you know, if I do all this other stuff, I'll be fine. And that myth is actually quite protective in a way, because they don't have the anxiety and the fear that people who know that is a myth mm-hmm. carry. And so sometimes when we know it's a myth through our lived experience, when we know that illness strikes no matter, you know, how healthy our lifestyle is, like no matter what we do, there's like a disparity between our experience of like not having that myth anymore and other people's experience of still kind of believing that they're in control of their bodies. And it can be frightening for them to think about how little control they really have. And that can set up that communication thing. And obviously, when people have lived experience of, you know, chronic illness and the uncertainty of their bodies, they don't want to burst the bubble of their, you know, friends and family and everything. So it does kind of set us up a little bit. So again, try and answer your question quickly. What I would say is, you know, when you hear something like that, it's kind of important. Like for me, it's important to hear about it, to hear it in a way that contains a little bit of compassion. Like, this person doesn't have the lived experience I have. They're trying to say something that's positive and kind. And I have a choice here about opening up to my actual lived experience of what's going on for me or moving on with the conversation, you know? And it's a tricky choice. And I think when I'm like in the hospital, this happens to me all the time where I'll be like in the ward, you know, meeting with somebody and they say, you know, let's say it's a woman and she's like, you know, my partner, you know, my husband or whatever, doesn't understand, you know, he doesn't get it. He has no idea, you know, what I'm going through, blah, 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 right? And then I go out in the hallway and there's the partner, the husband waiting. And of course, I can't talk to them about what the person said. So I just have to stand there. And what they say is, you know, she never talks to me. She never tells me what's happening, you know? And both of those people are protecting each other. Like the husband is trying to help and you know, do that. And the wife is trying to help by not sharing the difficulty. It's a really interesting trick.
Yeah, it's like you, like I said at the beginning, this is a fascinating area. And absolutely don't worry about trying to answer these questions quickly, because everyone listening is hanging on every word like I am. But that is the thing. It's a protection almost of each other. And yes. And because you love someone, or whether it's yes. your partner or your family or your friends or whatever, because you love them so much, you yes. almost don't want to burden them with how bad it is.
Exactly,
but,
Peter.
But they're trying to help as well. And, mm-hmm. and we're really lost in that. And how do we encourage people to talk? You know, I know it's a huge question. It's a broad question. But is there a simple step that we can take to initiate that conversation? Because it is a fear of being labeled as well for the person that has that lived
yes.
experience.
Yeah. And I mean, what you said before about the invisibility of it. You know, how, you know, you're not walking around with a crutch and you're not, you know, people aren't automatically in their heads putting you in the space of maybe needing assistance or accommodation or whatever. Okay. So, yeah, thank you for saying I don't have to answer things quickly. And what's really interesting about your question around communication is for people who have hidden illnesses, there's a piece around disclosure. And that is actually a very nuanced, tricky space, because you have to decide like who to tell, when to tell, and what to tell, and why to tell, right? Because it's like, you know, do I tell my boss because it's going to be tricky for me to travel during a flare, knowing that that will be then in my boss's head the next time, you know, something, you know, so it's a very tricky space. And that's also true, like you were describing with partners, where it's like, do I say again how difficult this is? Or do I assume that my partner knows this and I don't have to say it again? And I mean, we do this, you know, Living Well program, and I know you're going to ask me about it later too. Well, I hope you will, because I love talking about it. And Arthritis Ireland has the Living Well program. But one of the things we talk about on that program is the idea of I messages, you know, that you speak from your own experience. You know, I'm experiencing this, I'm experiencing this. And that allows the other person to kind of decide how they want to enter the conversation, rather than starting with a you message like, you know, you need to understand how difficult this is for me, right? Which can possibly set up, I see you smiling, right? You know, you know, that can set up some defensiveness.
Anybody who's been in a relationship can understand and relate to that.
It doesn't even have to be an intimate relationship, yeah. Even with a boss. Like if I went in and was like, you need to understand, you know, whatever. It's like, yeah. Whereas if you start with the, you know, I'm experiencing a lot of difficulty this morning, or I'm experiencing a lot of difficulty around this thing and it's making me feel X, it allows that person a moment to situate themselves in that conversation in a less defensive way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't always work, but that can sometimes work. But I just want to underline how tricky that disclosure piece is for people. And it's not the kind of thing where you do it once and it's done, because people live with the myth of health. They live with this, you know, and people have other stuff going on. So sometimes we have to come back to it and come back to it and come back to it. And that's a very hard place, on top of dealing with all the symptoms, on top of dealing with, I mean, all the medical stuff. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's a full-time job sometimes, carrying a long-term health condition.
Yeah, and we have that. We have our full-time job.
You have your other full-time job, your parents, you know.
You have all that. You're trying to disclose. You're trying to decide what to do. And then in amongst all of that, mm-hmm. we're trying to be good friends. We're trying to be good partners and clean the house or clean the bathroom when it's our turn.
Yes.
We're trying to make sure that we're still connected to a quote-unquote normal life. And that... Would you talk to a lot of people for whom that is almost a trigger for difficulty, because they're trying to maintain a sense of normality and yet they're disconnecting from the real world and the real life?
Oh, yeah. I think that's really, really a difficult place to be. As we all get older, like, you're more interested in Buddhism. It's just one of those things that happens. I was talking to TY transition year students last week, and I was like, anybody interested in Buddhism? There's like no hands up. I'm like, wait till you're 50. You'll all be. But the reason I mentioned it is, you know, I'm a mindfulness teacher, and you have to go through, like, there's a lot that goes into that. And understanding some Buddhist philosophy is part of that. And one of the really interesting things about Buddhist philosophy is that, you know, they have this thing called the Four Noble Truths. And the first truth is suffering, you know, that people experience suffering. And that is this kind of Eastern philosophy, right? We can say that. Now, on the other side, we can look at kind of science, hard science around suffering. And there's a really interesting cohort called the Dunedin Cohort out of New Zealand. And they've been followed from birth and studied in lots and lots of different ways. And they started looking at their mental health at age 11. And they've been following them all along and interviewing. And they're interviewed and assessed by psychologists and psychiatrists. So it's not like a student thing. You know, it's a very well-controlled longitudinal study. And I think it might have been 2017. I can't remember the exact date of the paper that I love the most that came out around this cohort. And they publish on this cohort all the time. But they were like coming up to age 40. And they were looking at, over the course from age 11 to age 40, when they were looking at all their mental health outcomes, the percentage of people who could at one point during that time been officially diagnosed, according to the diagnostic tools that we use in my profession, with a major mental health difficulty. Do you want to guess, Peter? Like, what percentage of people do you think between age 11 and 40?
I'd imagine, since you're asking me, it's probably pretty high. And knowing my own history and everyone else's, it's probably maybe 70, 75%.
Okay, you're close. 83%.
Wow.
83%. And the actual study that I read was about the 17% that could never have been diagnosed. And it was in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, and it was called Persistent Mental Health, which is like so funny because they were saying that's actually abnormal. And those people who didn't have these periods, they were like, they looked at why, and it was essentially like constitution. It was like they were just born merry and they stayed merry.
Right. I wonder what that's like.
I know. Exactly, Peter. And they actually did better in life, too. So we hate those people, right? But the reason I mention it is because, you know, we have this Eastern philosophy of suffering that's part of who we are. We have this Western science that says suffering is part of who we are. And then we have some kind of crazy expectation that we should be crushing it all the time. You know, that we should be ambitious, we should be achieving our goals, we should have great relationships, we should be feeling good about ourselves. Like, we have this kind of sense that if we're low, if we're struggling, there's something uniquely wrong with us. And so I like to mention that because it's like, no. This is part of our experience. This is a really hard thing that we're trying to do. And if you layer on to, like, you know, all the stuff that we do, and if you layer on top of that, having the experience of a long-term health condition, you know, that's very powerful too. And so the first thing I know, again, really long mm-hmm. answer, right? But you're saying, like, what if we can't do everyday tasks? Like, what if we can't do our chores? Like, what if we're not seeing our friends? What if we're not, you know, and it's like, okay, the first thing I would say is, what is your expectation for yourself? Like, what are you supposed to? I got air quotes going on here on the radio, which isn't great. You know, what are the demands that you're making on yourself here? And I mean, there's so much more research recently around the idea of compassion and self-compassion. And, you know, a lot of psychologists are working in that space where it's like, can I be as kind to myself as I would be to my best friend? You know, which is a really good question to ask yourself. Like, you might say to your best friend, come on now, let's go. We got to get up. Let's go. Right. But you wouldn't say, what's wrong with you that you're not already up? Like, you would never say that to your best friend. My best friend would never put up with that.
That's another question. Yeah.
But I mean, that's why she's my best friend, right? But the first question I would have, or the first element that I would say is, look at your expectations. And then the next thing is all the stuff that people know, like around pacing, around, you know, making sure that their life is balanced. What they're doing is that they're achieving things, and they're also doing pleasant things. Because a lot of times people with chronic illnesses will prioritize the stuff that they have to do, and they won't do anything that they want to do. And that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, that can only lead downhill, really, because you're putting so much pressure on yourself. And that's when you've come to the position that you're talking to somebody like yourself, where you're beginning to analyze these and you're putting in those support structures as such. But what are we looking out for? What are people looking out for in themselves or their someone that's close to them around anxiety and depression? What are those symptoms and signs that we're looking for that can lead us to try and make things better?
I like to think about, what are people thinking? What are people doing? And where are people? You know, are they getting out? Like, what's their environment like? Are they seeing their friends? Are they thinking thoughts? I mean, we all have negative thoughts, right? But is there a balance going on in their minds? Are they able to appreciate joy? Are they able to? I mean, if you go back to the very beginning of psychology, and every psychologist is going to cringe when I mention Freud, but still a fan, right? But he talks about, like, are you able to work? And that doesn't mean like paid work, right? But are you able to do something that's constructive? Are you able to play? And are you able to love? And those things, I think, can be valuable. Like, it just kind of sums it up. You know, am I doing something constructive? Am I having a little bit of fun? And am I able to reach out to other people? Now, obviously, there are like diagnostic criteria for depression and anxiety. You can Google those, right? But one of the really important things to think about with that is, like, how pervasive and for how long, mm-hmm. right? So is it covering all the elements of your life? Okay, so is it, you know, hitting your, like, if we talk about anxiety, you know, are these thoughts and behaviors around work? Are they around love, you know, your family? Are they around your friends? Are they around yourself, the world, you know, all of these things? Is it covering everything? And then is it going on for a long period of time? You know, and I don't mean like years, I'm talking about weeks. Or is it up and down? So if it's up and down, well, then we might be talking about a difficult period in a life of suffering. But if it's pervasive all the time for weeks, well, then that's a real sign. You might be looking at, you know, it might be a good idea to talk to somebody about it. And does that make sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think some people think that we almost have to be at our wit's end, completely at the end of our tether, completely
right.
to go and seek support. But that's not the case. Sure, it's not.
No, it's not. And in fact, services, you know, I mean, there's like community mental health, you know, there's like the high tier service. But there's a lot of services out there for people, you know, at that first step where it doesn't have to be like a significant mental illness. It might just be, you know, wanting to chat. You know, there's a lot out there, and it can be much easier to manage at that level rather than waiting for it to become more serious.
It's similar to our pain management or anything like that, that we can deal with this earlier, and it takes less to deal with if we can get in there early.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. Thank you so much for saying that. I think that's a really valuable point.
And how do we go about it? So if we do have someone in our lives who we're a little bit concerned about, or we're thinking ourselves, listening in and kind of saying, that might relate to me, how do we broach it? How do you bring up that conversation with somebody? We mentioned our friends earlier, you know, that you wouldn't say certain things to them, but talking to ourselves even, how do we bring that subject up?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I'm just going to park that for 1 second, Peter, because there's one thing I just wanted to say in the last question that I didn't get a chance to say because it fled out of my mind. And that was a really good first symptom to watch for, like a really good thing, even to assess yourself or to assess somebody that you love, is withdrawal, right? So if you notice yourself pulling back from contact with other people or things you enjoy, or, you know, whatever it is, like you stop reading, you stop, you know, whatever it is, if you notice your partner or, you know, whatever, pulling back, that's a sign. And what's really interesting about that is that also happens when we're ill, right? When we have a flare, when we have, you know, people have to pull back from demanding things, right? And so it can be the beginning of a cycle. Like, you really have to watch for that, because when you have to pull back from stuff because you're minding your body and you're, you know, you have to rest more and all the stuff that goes along with inflammation and flares and all that stuff, you really have to make sure that you're not also cutting out contact with other people, even if you have to change the way that you do it. So maybe more on the phone rather than face to face, or, you know, maybe you're engaged in, you know, chat groups or that kind of stuff, you know, just making sure that when you have to withdraw to care for yourself, it doesn't mean you're closing all the doors around you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I just wanted to come back to that in the, like, what should we watch for?
Sure. Yeah. No, it's important for people to be aware of these things as well. Mm. Yeah.
But starting the conversation. Okay. So you said starting the conversation with other people or starting the conversation with ourselves. So let me just think about that for a sec. So starting the conversation with other people, again, that's a place where it might be a really good idea to use an iMessage. You know, to say, this is something, you know, I've noticed that maybe you're not going out, or I've noticed that you're not responding to my texts. Is everything okay? You know, something like that. I'm trying to remember the acronym of the skill that sometimes we teach the students in medical school. But essentially what it is you notice something, you state what the thing is that you've seen. So awfully, like, a behavior is really good there. So I've noticed you stopped responding to my texts, or I've noticed you've stopped coming to class, or I've noticed that, you know, you're going to bed at 7:15 every night. State the behavior, and then you state why you're asking. Okay, so it's like, I'm only asking because I love you. I'm only asking because I'm worried about you. I'm only asking because whatever, okay? And at that point, the other person gets to decide that disclosure thing, right? Yeah. They get to decide, do they welcome you into the conversation? Are they going to, you know, step into that? Or do they say, oh no, actually, I was just really busy. It's fine. Which might mean I'm fine, or it might mean I don't want to talk to you about this, right? But either way, they've heard the message that you care enough to ask.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Because we need to be there for each other. And whether it's this time or it's the next time, they know that they have someone that they can approach and go to if they need to.
Yeah, that you've left that door open. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, I mean, depending on the kind of intimacy level that you have with the person, and I don't mean physical intimacy, although that could be part of it. I mean, you know, whether it's a best friend or a close friend or a colleague, you know, however far somebody is from your inner circle, you can always come back. And you can say it again. You can say, you know, the next day, you know, gosh, you know, I'm still thinking about that. You know, just because I love you, or just because I care about you. Underline, you're still there.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And that's always important, to make sure that we have those support networks and mm-hmm. and the people around us who are doing it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that really got to me, but it also gets to so many other people, is that differentiation or the cycle of psychological pain and what's going on in your head and how you're feeling, and then the physical pain, and which comes first, the almost chicken and egg syndrome of that. And how do we differentiate? Do you notice that they are intertwined massively in clinical settings?
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. I mean, like I said, it's a myth that we have control of our bodies. Like, it's a myth. You know, people walk around and don't pay attention if they're lucky. But most of us have to pay attention to our bodies. And that creates thinking, you know, and thinking about our bodies and what do we, you know, this. And so how we experience our bodies also creates, you know, physical reactions, which then ties into what we're experiencing from our body. So there's definitely that mind-body. You know, I mean, Descartes was like a wonderful philosopher and said many important things, but that mind-body dualism, I think, has been a challenge for us ever since. We're pretending like they're separate. And there's one, I mean, there's an activity we do on a course that, on the Living Well course, you know, where it's like people think about a lemon. And as soon as you start thinking and really thinking about a lemon, your mouth starts to water. It's happened to me already. I've done it a lot, you know. And you feel, okay, that's a physical reaction to a thought. Or something I sometimes do with parents is like remember a time when your kid got injured. Right. And as soon as I do that, like if I think about this one time with the, you know, those Heelys, oh God, I hate Heelys, right? And my son's knee opened up and I can feel it. As soon as I think about it, I can feel that sensation in my stomach or in my fingertips.
Yeah.
You know, that's how closely linked what we think is with our bodies. But there's a mistake sometimes people make where they're like, if I was more relaxed or if I was better able to manage my stress, my body, you know, it's like they almost start blaming themselves for having like inflammatory conditions because we know stress and inflammation is part of the whole thing. And that is a really dangerous place to be too, because that's not helpful at all to think, oh, you know, if I wasn't so stressed, I wouldn't have X, Y, or Z. And people do think that. And I've met a lot of people with X, Y, and Z who aren't particularly stressed. You know, sometimes our bodies just create stuff. And we know, I mean, particularly with depression, that there's a lot of research around inflammation and depression. So it might be interlinked. So, you know, you might have had to restrict activities, which has made you more vulnerable to depression. And then the depression, you know, the depression happens, it's like co-occurring, you know, or it's like a related to your experience of illness. But it might also be just two symptoms of inflammation. So it's really important that we don't add an extra layer of suffering by beating ourselves up for having negative thoughts or anxious thoughts. Does that make sense? Do you know what I'm talking about,
yeah,
Peter?
Yeah, I do indeed. All too well.
Yes. Okay. And there's, I mean, and I hate to do the Buddhist thing again, but can't escape it, right? But I remember I had a meditation teacher once who always talked about the second arrow, you know, where it's like the first arrow is the horrible thing that we're dealing with. So the first arrow is maybe not getting a promotion, or the first arrow is the fight you had with your partner, or the first arrow is some suffering that you're experiencing somewhere. And that is hard enough to deal with. The second arrow is like, what's wrong with me that I'm not better at this? Or I shouldn't have to put up with this thing that happened. It's like the interpretation of what's wrong with me and the world because the first arrow happened. And that's a very painful arrow that we can avoid if we stick closer to the actual terrible thing. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it comes back to the communication, the listening, yes, how we talk to ourselves. And that's really all wrapped up in our kind of what our responsibility as self-managers. So,
yes.
So you know, we've mentioned it a few times. We've mm-hmm. talked about it a couple of times about pacing, balance, communicating with ourselves as we would to other people.
Yeah.
But self-management really has a massive role to play in all of this, doesn't it? And,
yes,
you know, I'm a huge advocate of the Arthritis Ireland Living Well program. You know, I know you are as well.
We're in the same cult.
We don't have all the time in the world to go through it. But we do have to emphasize the importance of it, because it manages anxiety. It maintains relationships. It allows us to feel and live so much better, doesn't it?
Oh, Peter. Okay, so how much time exactly do we have? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I mean, okay, so the Living Well program, for those of you who might not be familiar with it, is a six-week program out of Stanford University originally. And it just has this unbelievable research base. Like, it's amazing how many people have studied this. I mean, it's been studied around the world. It's also been studied specifically in Ireland. I mean, I've been involved in a couple of different research projects around it. And it's so helpful because I think, you know, when you go into your doctor, or your nurse or whoever it is that you're a health professional, they give you some guidance, right? And then they assume that you know how to do everything that they're telling you to do, like how to balance, you know, how to pace or how to talk to people about your illness or even how to take medication or how to find another health practitioner. You know, people assume that we have these skills. And like, how would we have the skills? Because it's like we have to learn skills. Skills have to be learned. And so that 6-week program touches on all of those pieces. It's like the nuts and bolts of managing a long-term health condition. And it's very practical. Now, it does, we know from the research, again, the international research, that it also treats depression and anxiety. But I mean, that's like a bonus for me. I call it like psychology by stealth, right? But actually, it's the skills building that's the most amazing thing. And the other good, I mean, there's so many amazing things, but also it's taught by people with long-term health conditions. So it's not another program you go to where a health professional is explaining how things should be. It's like people who know. And that is extremely helpful. Now, I do like to say, because the term self-management, like self-management does not mean alone management, right? It's not like we're saying, oh yeah, you really need to self-manage your illness. Good luck to you, right? And I think that is a really good thing that comes out of the Living Well program is it's like self-management together, like learning from other people, learning communication skills so that you can help your health professionals, you can help your partner, you can help your children, you can help your colleagues to help you manage to your condition. And so I just like to say, because sometimes when people hear self-management, they think it's like a blow off. You know, it's like, oh yeah, here's some skills, go self-manage your illness. And that is not what this is about.
Yeah. And it's not getting rid of and saying, oh, you have to do it all on your own and disappear. It's a combination with everything else included. All the things that we talk about, mm-hmm. whether it's exercise or nutrition or whatever it may be, the psychological aspects, yeah. Everything is included. And it's that peer element, really, isn't it? We talked about it earlier, that yes. importance of someone who understands what you're going through. They do. The leaders are guides rather than teachers, almost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, what's really cool about it, too, is because I've been on the program for a long time. And it's like, you know, I started out as a health professional who didn't have a long-term health care. But then it's just like, oh, just wait a few years. I mean, you know, 50% of people over 50 have at least one long-term health condition. So, you know, sure enough, I'm over 50. I got a long-term health condition. And it's like I learn stuff every time I run that program. Somebody says something and I'm like, oh, my God, I can totally use that. You know, I'm not the expert in that forum. I mean, I'm never the expert in any forum, really. I mean, but like particularly in that forum, I'm not the expert. I'm constantly learning. And that, and I think that's true for all the leaders. And it's definitely true for the participants because that's the feedback that we get. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you've had that experience, Peter. Oh,
that's exactly what it is, that you're constantly learning from each other, passing on tips, passing on skills. As you said, they have to be learned. They're not just innate in all of us. We all have to learn them.
Yeah.
And that's the joy and beauty of the course itself is to pass it on.
Yeah. Yeah. And people can access that course through Arthritis Ireland. I mean, you guys have been doing it longer than anyone else in the country. And, you know, under, you know, Grania's leadership, it's just been gone from strength to strength. But you can also access the Living Well program through the HSC now. So it's funded across the country and you can look up hsc.ie/livingwell and you can find it there too. And it's the same exact course.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been absolutely fascinating. The time has flown.
What? We're done already, Peter? More to say.
I'm sure we could spend hours going through it all. I do have to wrap it up for today. Dr. Jennifer Wilson O'Reilly, Principal Clinical Psychologist in Beaumont, it's just been a pleasure and thank you so much for joining us on Inflammation Nation.
Thank you so much, Peter.
That's all from this episode of Inflammation Nation. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or as they always say, wherever you get your podcasts. For further information about arthritis, you can visit our website, arthritisireland.ie, or contact our helpline on 0818 252 846. See you next time. Inflammation Nation is supported by Pfizer.